Okay, just on the next go around, I got the Victor Echo 7. I didn't get the rest of the call sign, but I'll, you'll do it to me on the next one. I'd like to try, you know, because I know I spoke to Yaesu about it, and they said that the ATAS 120 won't really tune to 80. I looked around. I've never really found anything that can go that, for a mobile anyway, that will go to 80, but that's why I brought it up with the net. I thought maybe, I know there's other guys out there that have more experience than I do using mobiles and maybe could come up with something, but... Well, that's okay. I mean, I get a good signal down on 40. I put a ground strap. What happened originally, I couldn't even get 40, but until I spoke to Yaesu tech support, what I did is I had a piece of copper ground strap underneath the bracket of the antenna, and then found a metal on the car and screwed it in to get a good ground to the car, and 40 works great. All right, so I'm good. I just give me that V7, the rest of that call sign, please. This is N2HVR back to that.
Yeah, what I heard that Craig tell us, Craig and John tell us, was Victor Echo 7, India Sierra Victor. Victor Echo 7, India Sierra Victor, /links. Was, I think, the beginning of the website. Let me turn it over to John to give me a correction on that. KD2FQU Mobile, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Correct, Dick. It is Victor Echo 7, India Sierra Victor.com /links.htm. And he even suggests that you have to fully extend the ATOS in order to fine tune it. He claims 1.5 to 1 with that coil, SWR.
Very fine, John. So there's a little bit more to it. Victor Echo 7, India Sierra Victor, .com/links.htm, if I understand correctly. So, I think you're going to find a possible solution there, Nick. And when you do, come back and let us know how well it worked. N2HVR, K2LAW in the TechNet.
W2CH back.
We're going to pick up Roy in a second. Let's make sure we got this one first. N2HVR. I need any further fills, Nick? K2LAW.
That's great. Thanks, Dick, everybody on the net for the suggestions. And I copied down the Victor Echo 7 in the Sierra Victor.com links, and I'll check it out. I'd like to look at it myself. But like I said, you know, I don't want to damage the radio either. It's a great radio, so I'm going to be careful with this because I don't want to force it to go to 80 meters if it's not going to work. You know, so be it, because it's a nice radio. I don't want to actually blow the finals on it. But I'll check into it. I thought maybe there would be an easier solution, but I guess there's not. Thank you so much for the information. This is N2HVR. Back to you, and thanks a lot.
Yeah, good luck with that process, Nick. As I said, let us know. And so Roy now has got some further information, and I hope the signal is coming through a little better now. Whiskey 2, Charlie Hotel, K2RIW, go ahead, Roy, or Ray.
Yes, Dick, K2RIW in the net, W2CH, yes, this is Ray in White Plains. Yes, I put the HT onto the amplifier and a J antenna. I just quickly came back to you in the HT with a whip out the terrace here, and it wasn't enough, sorry about that. I was trying to say I've had the ATAS antenna a few years ago on the car, Monte Carlo, which we don't have now, so I don't have it anymore, because the car I have now is leased and I can't use that. But the car we had that I owned was not working with that. I returned it pretty quick to HRO. got the Diamond SD330, which was pretty new then. Comes with two sides of whips, and with the longer whip, I could tune down to 80 meters, I guess 75 too, but I wasn't doing much down there with the CW, and did use it like in the New York QSO party for the 80 meters and so on, and it worked fine. So that seemed to work for me. I had one ground strap to the trunk, and that was my experience with DHF and up through 6 meters with the Yaesu FT-857, where the transceiver was in the trunk and the head up in the front dash. So those were my comments. I hope it was clear this time, Dick. K2RIW in the TechNet, W2CH.
Yeah, well done, Ray. 100% copy that time. We heard everything. So that amplifier did the trick. Yeah, the handy talkie was a little bit too weak for the machine, and it was dropping out. Thank you for all the information. And, okay, I think we've gone down the list of everybody who signed in. And now we're good. I think it's time to go over to the mailbag. And we're exactly on time. We don't try to be regimented, structured, but today we are, whether we want to be or not. We've got to make sure this is not a precedent, John. KC2WGB, the man with the mailbag. And I hope you didn't get 275 emails this week. K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, maybe our clocks are wrong. Yeah, we don't want to spoil, that's for sure. Oh, well. Let's see. All right. We have a question here from Golf Uniform Z, I believe in New Jersey. He's questioning long delay echoes of 20 to 30 seconds on 80 meters. How is that possible? Maybe you can give me a result for that one, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
I think the answer is it can't happen. For you and I to look at reflecting objects, obviously the moon is an extremely large object, 2,200 miles in diameter, quarter million miles away. So there's a big reflecting object at a great big distance, a quarter of a million miles. But at the speed of light, the signal goes to the moon and comes back 2.5 seconds later. I've heard my own echoes off the moon, 2.5 seconds. And there's 100 guys out there who have done moon bounce, and they've all experienced 2.5 seconds of delay. So when you get a long delayed echo on, say, 20 meters, and you get something like 20 seconds or more, and we're talking about lots of millions of miles, okay? So lots of millions of miles is some kind of a reflector out there you want to believe. And when the reflector is that far away to give you enough signal strength, that echo would have to be something that is, the echoing device would have to be very large compared to a 2,200 mile diameter moon. You can see you're running into a whole lot of difficulty here. How in the world do you get an echo device that's that big, that you can't see, that far away, to give you that much delay? That's a tough one. Let me drop. Now, a signal at the speed of light, a signal could go around the Earth, if you had real favorable ionospheric conditions, could the signal go around the Earth multiple times? And how many times would be required to get 20 seconds? And the answer is a huge number. It takes only milliseconds to go around the Earth. And so, can you explain it that way? No. And the bottom line is that lots of people for lots of years have speculated where in the world are the long delayed echoes coming from. I would much rather think that some nasty guy is making a tape recording and putting it back 20 seconds later. That's a little bit more believable. So these LDEs, we've been hearing them from time to time for the last 80 years of ham radio operation. And that's particularly difficult to explain way back in the, I'm guessing the very first report of a long delayed echo may have happened way back in 1925. Well, 1925, you didn't have a tape recorder. So how does a person record the signal and play it back in 1925? And yet they're fairly sure they did hear long delayed echoes of multiple seconds way back then. It's a mystery. It's a tough one. I'm going to pass it over to the net. If you guys got any speculation as to where LDEs are coming from, let us know. I know there's been a few articles written on them, and I'm reasonably sure the articles didn't come to an exact conclusion that this is what it is. I don't think anybody's got a good explanation. So if you know something about LDEs, or if you have personally experienced one, give me a call with us right now. K2IW in the TechNet.
ADH with a comment.
ADH. Okay. Give me the full call and your name, sir.
I'm sorry, that was WA2VDH, Victor David Henry. Name is John. The comment I made is when I saw that original article back, I think it was back in the 68 or 69 issue of QST. At that time, I was at City College. There was a teacher I had. He was a ham, and it was in physics. He mentioned that the mechanism was that some sort of cyclotron waves or some kind of slow waves which were propagated or generated in the ionosphere, and they propagated very slowly, and then there was some mechanism not well understood that converted it back to RF. So it was some type of a wave that were generated in the ionosphere that had slower propagation, and then converted back to RF and received what appeared to be an echo. Go ahead.
Okay, so your college professor said those words to you way back then. And 1968 QST had an article on it. I have worked with slow wave structures, both the helix that's designed of a traveling wave tube, a helical antenna, not very much work, but I've done a little. The director string that's on a very long Yagi is a slow wave structure. And the slow wave structures that I've worked with, you get a velocity factor of 50%, 70%, very similar to the velocity factor you get with coax. For the ionosphere to do that, does it have the resources to make a slow wave structure? I mean, many of these slow wave structures are really a cascading of resonators. And how do you make the ionosphere act like a cascading of resonators? And the number of them required to give seconds of delay when ordinarily the speed of light is 1 nanosecond per foot or 1 millisecond per kilometer. Numbers like this, to get many multiple seconds, is still very tough. I'm not convinced we've got an answer. Was it real? Well, when you get multiple people reporting it simultaneously, it's hard to say that it's just one guy dreaming. It looks like it really does happen. But how does it happen? Wow. There have been very fancy... Let me drop this. There's been some very fancy metamaterial experiments. In other words, if you put together the right kind of materials as a cyclic structure, a step-and-repeat structure, you can synthesize a dielectric constant or a inductive constant. You can synthesize dielectric constants that Mother Nature has never created. That's one of the definitions of metamaterial. You made something that electronically acts in a way that Mother Nature never did. And so you can make crazy indexes of refraction and whatever, but you've got to work very hard at it. It's not something that happens by accident. So as I see it, we got a problem explaining it. And it happens to dawn infrequently, and it happens at times when people are not planning it. I mean, you may be holding your QSO with your buddy in South Africa, and all of a sudden, either you or he or both of you start hearing a long delayed echo. And can you duplicate it again the next night and start setting up instrumentation to make measurements? Well, whatever is doing it is not that cooperative. It's a tough one. So I'm not convinced we've got an answer. I think that stumped us on this one, John, and maybe this man's in line for the great big prize that we give out for people who stump all the experts that sign into the TechNet. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. He's a volunteer. He's a candidate.
KC2WGB. That's right, Dick. Well, he won the affordable award of being able to come back and ask another question. By the way, I did make a mistake. It's 15 to 30 seconds, not 20 to 30 seconds. Not that it makes that much difference. But, and also, there were recordings he was listening to. But I sort of agree with you. I think most of them are probably somebody recording it and playing it back. It could even be done automatically, something like that. I have never heard of that long. You know, maybe 6 seconds, I think, is the longest, or 4 seconds around that time. That's even tough to, you know, explain.
John, it sounds like you've got experience. 4 to 6 seconds of long delayed echo. What band were you on? How long ago? Who were you talking to? Was it heard on both ends? Stretch out the story a little bit here. Tell us what you've experienced on this one, John. I've experienced echoes on 432 that are milliseconds long. But seconds long. Wow. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, it was 20 meters, if I remember correctly. It was around 6 years ago. I was listening to a conversation, and one ham had an echo. The other didn't. And, you know, they were subflexing. And it was at least, I would say, 4 seconds. It was so apparent it was actually interfering with the responding transmission. So that was tough to figure out, and that had happened on 2 occasions, and they were both on 20 meters.
So when you're getting the long-delayed echoes shifted some number of seconds on 20 meters, and it's interfering with the signal you're listening to, and it wasn't just somebody else creating QR Mary. In other words, you heard the exact same Morse code, delayed X number of seconds, laid on top of the signal the guy is now sending. To even do that with a tape recorder is extremely difficult, because now you've got to be listening, recording, and transmitting simultaneously. So for you and I to set up equipment to do that, we'd have to have 2 antennas pretty widely spaced, so that the transmission out of one doesn't jam the receiver out of the other, and you got this tape recorder with 2 heads on the tape recorder, one recording and one playing back after a great big long tape loop. So to do it, even if I wanted to do it as a hoax, boy, that's tough. To do it as an overlay, if I understand correctly, you heard it as an overlay where the delayed signal for some significant period of time was essentially interfering with the direct signal. Wow. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, you've got it right. It's similar to having a 2-head machine, 1 head lagging, 1 head leading, so that you get the transmission. And you record the transmission, and the next head would be playing it back. And what's amazing is they were both being heard at approximately the same volume, the return signal from the response and that second transmitter signal. And it was just hard to discern what was going on.
The only way I think I could do that is that if you and me decide to create a hoax and we're a good number of miles apart, you're receiving the signal, playing it to me over, let's say, the telephone. I'm recording it with 2 separate heads that are displaced by a loop of tape, and then what's coming out of my playback head, I'm transmitting. Because you and I are miles apart, and we've carefully adjusted our antennas to be in the skip zone, so I'm not hearing you per se. I'm not hearing the signal directly, but you're not hearing my transmission directly while you're listening to the following guy. So 2 guys displaced a good number of miles with a telephone and a tape recorder could do that. But that's an awful lot of work to create a hoax. And this phenomena you heard let's see, the guy is going back and forth. You're hearing two sides of a conversation. Only one of them has got the LVE. How long did the condition persist? I mean, if this was a 10-minute QSO, did you hear it for the whole 10 minutes at roughly the same volume? Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Volume stayed the same, and if I'm not mistaken, it went on for about 8 minutes. Now, you're right, don't forget, that could be done on a studio. One guy could do that, and then play the tape. Yes, I agree with that, but it didn't sound like that. It sounded like a coherent conversation between two hands, and just something freaky. But you're right, that could be done in a studio.
Now, you heard this for 8 minutes. Is that because the QSO only lasted for 8 minutes? Or the phenomena disappeared after 8 minutes? Over to you, John.
AC2WGB. No, they were rag tuning for a while. I would say they were on for at least a good part of a half hour, Dick. But it didn't last long.
And I should have asked, the long delayed echo you heard, I'm guessing it was Morse code, but it could have been single sideband voice. And when it stopped happening after 8 minutes, was it an abrupt discontinue, or did it slowly fade? Over to you, John.
Yeah, it was a phone QSO, and let's say it started on the 12th, about 7 minutes into that half hour is when it started to come in, and it seemed to come in like a wave built to a crest and then faded out over that 7 minute period, 4 minute period, whatever it was. Then the rest of the half hour was normal conversation. But yeah, you described it pretty right, pretty much so, right on the target.
That's a tough one to explain. And do you think anyone else heard it at the same time? Probably not. How many people were tuned to that exact same frequency and listening to that exact QSO? You were listening to this particular QSO because you just happened to tune across it, and you heard this double voice-like condition, or these are people you know. How did you come upon this particular QSO, John? Go ahead.
Think about a half hour, an hour before that, I was having a QSO with somebody on that frequency, and I just went back into the lab, left the radio on, and a little while later, these two guys come on, start talking, and I walked in to lower the radio, and I started to notice that effect. I don't even remember the call sign, but it was so obvious something was wrong, and I was trying to figure out what, and of course, before I could figure it out, it had disappeared. They went on for the rest of it. 20 minutes that was left or whatever without any incident.
Make a guess from your memory, John. Were either of these guys a DX station? Where do you think the two guys that you were listening to were located?
I believe they were local, Dick. I don't think either one was a DX station. I would say possibly within... Oh, I'd say 100 miles, I'd say.
Yeah, 100 miles on 20 meters is almost inside the skip zone, if I understand correctly. Without a near vertical incident sky wave, nevus situation of antennas and propagation, that number of miles on 20 meters, under normal circumstances, you're beyond ground wave. But you're too close to get around the skip zone problem. I mean, on 20 meters, quite often, you'll hear a guy 1,000 miles away and he sounds like he's in your backyard. A guy 100 miles away, you can just barely hear him by extended ground wave. So he's almost inside that skip zone, isn't he, John?
Yes, there was a little noise, but they stayed pretty steady. It wasn't drifting in and out. It was pretty easy to copy, and both of them sounded almost equal in intensity. So it wasn't like, you know, one was far away. They sounded like they were probably the same radius from me anyway.
Okay. I think we have no explanation, John. That's a tough one. LDEs, are going to be a mystery for some time to come as I see it. Milliseconds of delay, easy to explain. Multiple seconds of delay at the speed of light, where you're talking about a zillion miles. And to get an echo device, I mean, as your distance increases, the so-called radar range equation tells you something called range to the fourth instead of range squared. In other words, when a signal propagates in one direction and you plot signal strength versus distance for a free space signal, one that's not being blocked by Earth curvature or whatever, it follows the inverse square law. Double the distance, you get one quarter of the amount of signal. But if you're playing with a radar and you're now getting an echo off of a target, so your transmission obeys inverse square law as far as the signal strength that gets to the target, then you get a radio echo off the target, and that echo comes back to you again by another inverse square law of signal strength versus distance. And the bottom line is that the radar range equation will tell you that distance versus signal strength for an echo on a radar follows the inverse fourth law. Every time you double the distance, you get a 12 decibel decrease in signal strength. That's a, I think it's a 16 to 1, if I understand correctly. Yeah, 4 to 1, 4 squared is 16. So every time you double the distance, you get 1/16th the amount of power if it's free space. Add Earth curvature to that, and it pulls off even faster. So to get a big enough echoing device following the inverse fourth law, and you're getting a signal above threshold, and the range is so darn far that you're getting multiple seconds of
repeater. Time out.
As I was saying, you're getting multiple seconds of delay. Boy, that's a tough one. It's a combination that on paper you can say to yourself, it can't be happening. And yet your ears and brain are saying, there it is. Your tape recording is saying, I've recorded it. I can play it back. There it is. And when it comes to the delayed signal, almost the same signal strength, was there any difference in the audio quality? Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
It was hard to tell because there was information going each way when that was happening, but the repeated signal sounded about at the same level with no extra noise, didn't seem to have been decreased at all, which should have been strange, but it was very easy to tell it was the second signal. Where? I don't know. Maybe they located the dark matter, that's what it's reflecting up there.
Yeah, that dark matter is proposed to be some kind of dust with a lot of mass to it, much more mass than all of the stars that you're looking at in a galaxy. And the dust is evenly distributed across the galaxy, so if the galaxy doesn't have a center of mass, it's got a distributed mass. And if you do it just right, the whole galaxy rotates like a wagon wheel instead of winding up like a spring, like a watch spring, which is what because almost every galaxy has got a supermassive black hole in the center, you would think it would follow what's called central force motion. A satellite close to the Earth has to move a hell of a lot faster in miles per hour compared to a satellite with a larger orbit. A geosynchronous satellite moves 6,000 miles an hour, 22,000 miles above the surface of the Earth, whereas a low orbit satellite, like the International Space Station, moves 17,000 miles an hour. So that's the normal central force motion, Keplerian laws of orbital mechanics. Let me drop. So if a galaxy followed those laws, the center of the galaxy would be spinning real fast, the perimeter of the galaxy would be rotating real slow, and therefore the whole thing would be, the bars in the galaxy would wind up like a spring, and eventually would wind up so tight you wouldn't even see the bars anymore. And yet, when you do a Doppler spread analysis of a galaxy by good radio astronomy or optical astronomy equipment, you find that the whole galaxy is rotating almost like a wagon wheel. All of it's rotating at the same rate. And it's very difficult to explain that without dark matter.
Okay.
This dark matter now, in order to follow those laws, would have to be somewhat evenly distributed across the galaxy, with quite a bit of it out at the perimeter. When you get a distribution of dark matter, like dust, is that going to act like a reflecting object, a planar object that does the reflection, so that all of the echo comes back at the same time? When you get an echo off the moon, you're getting a time domain smearing of it, because the sub-Earth portion of the moon is closer to you. It gives you an echo that comes back sooner than the perimeter of the moon, which is 1,100 miles further away from you. So you get a kind of a smearing in the time domain when you get an echo off the moon. These long-delayed echoes, from what you're describing, has got such high fidelity, it would have to be a perfectly planar surface with ideal orientation. And how do you force dark matter to do that for you? Who are you, John? KQLIW.
2NVR.
Mr. Chernobyl ship, that's explained. That's hard to explain, absolutely. Pick up the other station, dude.
2NVR, KQLIW, go ahead.
I think, Hanley, here's John. It's just northern. Business for me. One of the had to have because of okay. Over to you.
John, your signal was kind of weak. We only heard every third word, so we didn't get a coherent conversation. Anything you can do to give us a little more signal and repeat your message? Back to you, John.
Yeah, give me about 5 seconds. If you guys are talking a little bit more, I'll re-aim my antenna.
Go for it. Okay, I guess he's got to have our signal to go by. So, maybe you can begin the next question, John. Go ahead.
PC2WGB. Very good, Dick. All right, this is about a Yagi antenna. This young man is asking a question. That to have directivity, you've got to have gain and all that with the Yagi. He understands that. He's questioning the relationship of the two with the Yagi. If the position of the driven elements and reflectors is so important, how do they manage to get it broadband? Because as you change frequencies, he's saying those distances have to change also. So, where's the magic? KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
2NVR, back.
Okay, Mr. 2NVR, we keep missing the beginning. Go right ahead, John.
I worked in the broadcast world for many moons, and one of the things we used to have, in order to stay in compliance with FCC, we had to delay a live transmission so as to be in compliance with the fact that you can't put bad words on the air. Sometimes it was anywhere from 7 to 10, maybe 15, 20 seconds to give you time to make a decision whether you get off the tape or like that. You have it. Let me let this stop. Is this sounding okay to you, Dick?
A lot of improvement, John. Go ahead.
We used to have among other machines, a machine called a Spotmaster. And you could put pre-recorded or pre-existing into a machine, run it to a specific level at a specific duration to give you enough time to make a decision as to whether you want to put it on the air or not. Concerning whether or not you're and portion. Tape project 1.5 inches per second in accordance with what time you needed to have to make your decision. And it was a broadcast quality signal. You could never tell the difference in terms of how long it would take you to make that decision. But that's what we did to keep bedwars off the
Okay, so to meet your FCC requirements of no bad words on the air, you use this spot master thing. Was that done with a, I think you said at times you had 7 to 10 seconds of delay. Was that done with two separate heads on a tape recorder and a loop between the two that was 7 to 10 seconds worth of tape? One head is recording and one head is playing back. Is that approximately how it was done, John? Go ahead.
Basically, I mean, I just, I didn't like enough time for... we have a loop, a continuous loop of tape, quarter-inch tape, regular garden variety tape recorder stuff, and you can cut that or adapt the cartridge that the tape is in a continuous loop cartridge for however length of time you want it to have, or you have to make your decision about whether you're going to put it on the air or not. And then you could run the tape continuously with an erase head before, you know, the cartridge would run out of time to, you know, originate properly. And it was basically a relatively simple device, and it enabled you to, as I say, make your decision in terms of, you know, if you're a producer, director, whatever. And that way you can, you know, you can actually make your delay for as long as you want it. That applies, they have to keep doing that. I don't know how their methodology works, but the radio, we do it.
Yeah, I think I've seen those cartridges. Very fancy kind of a cartridge where it's got a reel of tape, and you're winding the tape onto the perimeter and taking the tape out from the center. Yes. Very fancy kind of a cartridge is what I think you're describing. Okay, in the case of a Yagi antenna, getting to the next question, let me drop. First of all, there's a zillion designs for a Yagi. In the early days could be as late as 1970, F9FT Franck Tona in the Reims, France antenna factory manufactured a very well respected 1296 Yagi that a lot of amateurs in the United States used. And Franck has a patent on using the first director as an impedance matching device as opposed to a gain device. And yes, as you play with the first director's length and position, you can change the impedance of the driven element by quite a significant range. What Franck and a whole lot of other people didn't realize is he didn't have to use the first director to do that. By simply changing the length of the driven element, you can make the resistive impedance go anywhere from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms, changing nothing by length. However, for almost every one of those lengths that you choose where you get the right amount of resistance, there's almost always some reactance left over. The reactance is very easy to cancel by putting a shunt capacitor or a shunt inductor right across the terminals of the driven element. So by adjusting the shunt reactor and adjusting the length of the driven element, you could make the impedance of the driven element of a Yagi anything from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms. Any reactance that you want, any resistive impedance that you want, by doing nothing by adjusting length and putting a tuning device. Some of those hairpin-tuned Yagis with the driven element, hairpin-fed driven element, were starting to use that phenomenon, although it didn't catch on. Let me drop it. But the raw data as to how to do this has been hidden in plain sight for 60 years. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, 1945, 1946, set up a whole bunch of monopole antennas on a great big sheet of copper. And they chose every possible length, every possible diameter, and really measured the impedance with a slotted line. In this slide rule, they did all the calculations and plotted all the data. The Brown and Woodward curves, one curve for the resistive value, one curve for the reactive value, have been in every single issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook ever since 1960. When the Engineering Handbook came out, they published that original article in 1946 in the IEEE proceedings. So the data has all been there. And if you know what you're looking at when you study that data, you realize that changing the length changes the resistance, changing the length changes the reactance, and because you're willing to put a shunt device across the driven element feed point, you can make the reactants go to zero if you want to on the job. So, a smart person tuning a Yagi following my philosophy, which you can read about in Mike number 2's location, that K1MJM has got this beautiful website. I call him Mike number 2 because Mike number 1, KC2NJI, is the guy who records all of these tech nets. You go to amateurradio.tv and you can play back the last 7 or 8 years of tech nets if that's what you want to do. You go to Mike number 2, which is the website of limartechnet.com, and you'll find out on that website there's an article by K2RIW as to how to get perfect impedance match of a dipole. So, and I'm just simply using the Brown and Woodward curves. It's amazing how that is not taught in any of the schools. Most antenna engineers, they barely know that there's a chapter 4 in every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, that curve number 2 and figure number 2 and figure number 3 in chapter number 4 of every issue has that data. Let me drop. When you study that data, you suddenly see that as you make the driven element of a dipole, or the driven element of a Yagi, larger and larger in diameter, at the UHF frequencies, this is easy to do because you're making the Yagi, if you want to, out of copper tape laid on a piece of film, and it's cut out just right so that it becomes a driven element, directors, boom, and whatever. You're making a Yagi out of wide elements. I'll admit to do this on 6 meters and 80 meters is a hell of a lot more difficult. But you make the driven element wide enough, the element starts becoming very broadband. Brown and Woodward curves will show you that. When you make a Yagi, where all of the elements are very wide, the directors, reflector, and the driven element, and I've got a patent on that exact kind of an antenna, a 3-element Yagi that covers 902 to 928 megacycles with extremely low Q. It's got a 1.05 standing wave ratio across that 3% bandwidth. So you could say the Yagi is extremely low in Q, yet it's simultaneously high in gain. It has more than 60 dB of gain over isotropic for 3 elements. Your next question is going to be, how in the world do you do both at the same time? Broad bandwidth, low Q, and high gain. And that's part of the magic of very wide elements. Let me drop. Whenever you make a resonator out of a very large conductor, as long as the conductor is highly conductive, it's not going to have I squared R loss. It's not going to have resistive loss. It's not going to be dissipating energy. The only way it can dissipate the energy is by radiating it into space. But when the element is large in diameter, you could say that the RF wave finds a way to go down that conductor along the perimeter, along the center, zigzag, whatever. It finds a way that allows it to resonate. That's one way of looking at it. What's really happening internally is kind of difficult to see because the usual modeling programs, your CST Microwave Studio, a $50,000 program, your High Frequency Structure Simulator, a $50,000 program. Maybe I'm a little high in the numbers, but at one time that was the price. These very expensive modeling programs have great difficulty doing high fidelity modeling of very large diameter radiators, very large width of very large diameter. The finite element analysis, where you have to take your conductor and break it into a whole lot of tiny little triangles, and the program has to calculate the amplitude and phase angle of the current or voltage that appears across every one of those triangles. It has to be able to do that in a complex manner. In other words, amplitude and phase, and it's got to be able to invert that mathematical matrix in order to do the analysis, and the program can't do it. So the modeling programs will not tell you that there is a solution in this direction. Let me drop. But you take a guy with a ham radio philosophy who who likes doing tinkering, and he's got in front of him a good Rohde & Schwarz brand name vector network analyzer, and he's building broadband antennas with three elements to them on a portable handheld device for an RFID reader at 915 megacycles, and he wants an extremely low standing wave ratio, 1.05 to 1 standing wave ratio, for the frequency re-jump of 902 to 928 megahertz inclusive. You get that kind of a guy tinkering that, that's exactly what I did 10 years ago, and you find this solution, and you try to model it, and the modeling program says, no, it doesn't exist. So the Brown-Woodward curves gives you a clue. All of electronic studies that we take, where you build resonators, an inductor and a capacitor, combined in series or in parallel, to give you a resonance phenomenon, we're taught, as rammed into our brain, high Q is desirable. Keep the resistance low. Keep the quality of the coil high and the quality of the capacitor high. High Q as a resonator is desirable because it gives you low insertion loss and high selectivity. Let me drop. So because that information is rammed into your head day after day, high Q is desirable. Do everything you can to keep the Q high. When it comes to a shielded resonator being used as a frequency selective device, a filter, to make sure just the right frequencies go into your radio or just the right frequencies go through the IF strip, that's exactly the right information. When you're building an antenna, it's the wrong information. But the courses and the books do not tell you that. That when you're building an antenna, you want to build it high in efficiency, meaning you're using high conductivity materials, but you want the Q to be low. You want the antenna to have a broad bandwidth with a low standing wave ratio. You want low Q. The only way you, in the case of a resonator that's using for frequency selecting, the only way that you lower the Q is because you've got resistance somewhere in the circuit that's eating up your energy. One of the definitions of Q is energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. So a high Q resonator is going to have very little energy dissipation per cycle. You're going to use very low loss materials. In the case of an antenna, you want the loss to be high because you want to radiate the signal. So therefore, low Q antennas are very desirable. The bottom of each one of those curves, the Brown-Woodward curves, shows you how to build a low Q antenna. Because everybody thought low Q is undesirable, they don't look at the bottom of those two curves. And they've been there since 1946 in plain sight. Ain't that crazy? So I haven't given you the whole explanation as to why it behaves that way. I'm not exactly sure. But if you do tinkering, like a good ham radio operator does, you're experimenting with an antenna, and you're trying to find out, does the element want to be longer or shorter? Let me drop. So in your hand is a tuning tool. You've got this long wooden stick with a piece of copper tape on the end of it. And you put that tuning tool near the tip of a driven element, or near the tip of a director, or near the tip of a reflector. And because you're adding capacitance to the tip, the element that you're putting that thing near now gets tuned to a lower frequency. You're watching the screen of the vector network analyzer. You're watching the standing wave ratio on the yellow curve. You're watching the gain as the blue curve. I mean, a good vector network analyzer can give you two curves simultaneously. Frequency horizontal, vertically one curve is gain and one curve is standing wave ratio. You want the yellow curve, the standing wave ratio, to go down. You want it to be low in standing wave ratio. You want the blue curve, the gain, to go up high. You want it to be high in gain. So because this is an antenna range where the vector network analyzer is sending a signal into the antenna on the test, you've got another antenna a few feet away that's picking up the signal. How much signal gets picked up by the second signal is called gain. How much signal is reflected from the first antenna is called standing wave ratio. And you display that as two separate curves. So you move around the tuning tools until the yellow curve goes down and the blue curve goes up. And you can do that experiment by laying down pieces of copper, doing the tuning tool waving technique. You can probably test 10 or 20 antenna designs in an 8-hour day very easily. You try to model each one of those antennas with wide elements,
It takes multiple hours of grinding of the computer program to give you an answer on one of those antennas, and the antenna you get out of that antenna program is very low in accuracy. Let me drop. So do it by computer program, you get a very poor answer in a very long period of time. Do it by tweaking, you get a very high quality answer in a very short period of time, and you can do a whole lot of them in any one single day. You can see the conflict here. Almost every single antenna vendor that I know of, somewhere in their advertisement, brags about the fact that they've got such high faith with the high fidelity computer modeling programs these days. They brag about the fact that they model the antenna first, then they build it. With that philosophy, they will never find this whole series of antennas that I have put my name on patent applications. There's a whole class of antennas they will never find by that process. Computer modeling can do a lot for you most of the time. If you jump into that bandwagon and have infinite faith in computer modeling, there are times when it will get you into trouble because it gives you very good looking answers that are dead wrong. Will the computer modeling someday also be able to handle this? I think so. That day has not yet arrived. You want to build a broadband high performance antenna today, you're going to use the ham radio philosophy, and you can do it by tinkering. Let me drop. Because use any of the computer modeling programs on an antenna and talk to a person who has done it, and you get him to start becoming very candid with you, and he'll eventually admit to you that, yeah, the computer program gets me into the ballpark, but I have to always do PCO. And you ask him, well, what is PCO? Post computer optimization. The computer program on most antennas with reasonable diameter elements gets you into the ballpark, but to get to home plate, you're still going to do some tinkering. But if you're starting off building very broadband antennas with very wide elements, you better do it all by tinkering. You better not do any computer modeling at all, is my opinion. Not everyone's going to agree with that. For me, it worked. And that philosophy has resulted in 30 antenna patents on that class of antennas. 30 antenna patent applications, of which 26 of them have been issued by the patent office so far, and 6 of those antennas are in full manufacture as we speak. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the tech net.
KC2WGB, just left a little time in there so we don't drop out the Eastern repeater. Okay, along with that question, he included that he asked a specific point where the Q, to maintain the Q, with the distance between the driven element and the reflected element, that distance is fixed. Now, as the frequency changes, the reinforced signal from the reflector is changing. So how is the Q maintained and about what bandwidth?
Okay, he's made a number of good logical sounding conclusions. He assumes that the spacing between the driven element and the first director is something that's got to be fixed. Absolutely not. There is a desirable distance between the driven element and the first director that maximizes the gain. Do not use that as an impedance matching device, is my philosophy. And for that matter, the distance between driven element and first director, distance between director number one and director number two, and so on, you could say all of those distances are changing in wavelength as you sweep the frequency. But if the elements are properly made wide enough, the right length, and approximately the right spacing, you will get the gain, and you'll get the gain over a significant bandwidth. In a case of a high-performance Yagi, 3% of bandwidth is good, but if your definition of bandwidth is not where the Vizwar hits 2 to 1, but your definition of bandwidth is where the Vizwar hits 1.05 to 1 maximum, that's an extremely broadband antenna with an extremely low standing wave ratio. and to build a handheld RFID reader where you're transmitting and receiving on the exact same frequency simultaneously. And you want to make sure the echo from your own antenna, in other words, the standing wave ratio, that's what echo really is, that's what VisWire really is, it's an echo of your antenna. You want that echo to be very low so that it doesn't jam your receiver, so you can hear the echo of the tag that's 10 feet in front of you. Let me drop. That design philosophy. The word Q on a antenna has nowhere near the meaning it has for a resonator. There are people who think a multi-element Yagi is a kind of a filter, multiple resonators with a certain coupling coefficient between them, and therefore you're building a Chebyshev or a Butterworth filter. Absolutely not. A Yagi antenna is not a filter. It has some of the filter characteristics. It's multiple resonators with a coupling coefficient between them. That's one way of looking at it. It's not the right way of looking at it. That string of directors out in the case of a long Yagi is a slow wave structure. And a slow wave structure has a certain velocity profile. That means somewhere along the boom, there's a certain velocity factor for each inch or each foot of the boom, so to speak. There's a certain desirable velocity factor for that location that will maximize the gain. It will maximize the focusing characteristic by Huygens principle. Let me drop. So when your questioner asked, what do you do to maintain the Q between the driven element and the first director, those words represent a problem. You're not trying to maintain the Q. You're not trying to keep...
Dick, he was talking about the reflector. It may be the same principles, but he was talking specifically about the reflector.
Same thing with the reflector. You don't want high Q. Good common sense, because everything you know about resonators used for frequency selection tells you that you want high Q for a resonator, for a filter. An antenna is not a filter. It's a radiator, not a resonator. You're not trying to maintain Q. You're trying to suppress the Q. You want to make the Q low so that the antenna has got bandwidth. It's opposite of common sense. So you're not maintaining the Q between reflector and driven element. You're not maintaining the Q between driven element and first director. And you can say that for all of the elements. Yagi design is a different philosophy, a different phenomena. Where does the gain come from? That string of directors out in front of a long Yagi is a magnifying glass. It's a synthesized structure. It is a skeleton structure that acts like a magnifying glass. And by the way, the way we're taught the way a magnifying glass does its focusing is almost wrong. We're taught that by the index of refraction, the light coming into the curve, the double convex piece of glass that you and I call magnifying glass, that the light goes into the glass and bends a certain way because of the shape of the double convex curve. And then it comes out and it focuses at a certain point. And if you're using that magnifying glass to focus the sun on your newspaper, you burn a hole in the newspaper. Let me drop it. And we think the focusing is taking place by way of the light being bent by what's called index of refraction. That's the way it's typically taught. It's almost wrong. It's sort of true, but there's a much better way of looking at it. You know that the light traveling through the glass travels more slowly. Index of refraction is giving you a hint of that. The velocity factor of the light going through the glass, I don't know the exact number, but it might be 70%. Because the light going through the center of the magnifying glass is going through a thicker chunk of glass, and the glass has got a velocity factor of 70% in my example, that light is more delayed in the center than the light that goes through the perimeter. Huygens' principle will tell you that once you calculate what is the wavefront in a particular situation, that you can put a million little dots along that wavefront and assume that each one of those dots radiates in a spherical manner. And then you put let those dots all expand a certain amount, and you find out where the new wavefront is, and you repeat the process. Well, because the light going through a magnifying glass gets more delayed in the center than it does at the perimeter, the beautiful planar wave from the sun that entered the magnifying glass comes out of the magnifying glass as a concave wavefront.